Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Somewhere in Vegas here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Mark the Q. I'm your host. Very busy today. We've got two guests coming on. In our bottom of the hour, we'll be talking to soul singer Chris Bell, who is one of the founding members of The Natural Four. We'll be talking about his book coming up and a little bit about his musical career. And that'll be coming on the bottom of the hour. But first, we have a very special guest. He's been doing radio for over 40 years, also a TV personality. And he's interviewed some of the most talented stars in the universe. His new book is called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon in a Galaxy of Stars. Peter Anthony Holder is on with us right now. How you doing, Anthony?
Just tickety-boo. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been interesting because, we come from the same kind of somewhat the same world. I'm always interviewing people on a weekly basis, and I'm always learning from some people as well in terms of, what their background is, some of their motivations as well. I mean, how's it been for you to be able to talk to so many people and just to gain like a little bit of knowledge every single time you interview these people?
Well, I started out doing a radio show. I did a nightly radio show for 3 hours a night. So that was a show that took a lot of time to fill. And when it came to talking to celebrities, it was a self-aggrandizing situation for me because I was a fan of these people. I've never been a person to back in the day, you would get autographs. Today's you would try and get selfies with people. But I was never a person to go after someone in that regard, because to me there was nothing in that connection, because there really wasn't any connection. I wanted to talk to people and get to know what their careers were like and what their lives were like and have a connection in that way, rather than thrusting a piece of paper in front of somebody and having them sign it, or quickly taking a selfie and, the second they walk away from you, they've probably forgotten you even existed.
Yeah, and the fact that like I said, there's more to them. They're really people too, as it's been said, and that's how I always focus my show too. It's just that, they have interesting stories, to ask certain questions, of people as well. I mean, maybe something that they haven't thought of for a while, or something that no reporter has ever asked them. I mean, you look at any typical reporter, if you go to any typical news junket, celebrities are usually asked the same questions over and over again, and it gets boring a little bit. Sometimes you have to dig a little bit deeper to ask a really interesting question, because it gets boring answering the same questions as well. I'm pretty sure you're very familiar with that. And I mean, what kind of things do you do to prepare for an interview?
Well, you talk about the junkets. I was one of those people who just abhorred the idea of the junkets. I just wouldn't do them, because even if you had original questions that you wanted to ask, you might be the literally 50th person they're talking to that day. So it doesn't make a difference how original your question is. If you're near the end of somebody's junket trip, they're just not into it. I mean, it's a contractual obligation for them to do that, and it's never any fun. I was lucky enough that I had conversations with people that would last anywhere upwards from a half hour to an hour in length. So you could really get into the weeds, as it were, and not be so focused on asking, whatever prepared questions you might have if you happen to prepare questions. I just thought of it as having, as the title of the book says, a great conversation. So I didn't go out of my way to prepare a lot of questions. Now, again, as I said earlier, I was a fan of a lot of these people to start with. So being a fan, I had questions just naturally. I didn't have to sit down and come up with them. And I just let the conversation go where it went. And even if I had prepared questions, because sometimes if somebody was promoting a book, you might get a tear sheet from the publicist. Even if I asked the first question in the on the tear sheet, that's probably the last question from that tear sheet I asked, because it just depended on where the conversation went.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty, it's the beauty of radio, and the beautiful thing about podcasting in general is the fact There is no restrictions in terms of how many minutes you have in podcasting. I mean, you could do a show from, you know, from anywhere from 45 minutes or, you know, 20 minutes all the way up to maybe an hour and a half. You know, it all hinges on how you get through the conversation. If there's a lot to be said or there's something to dig into a little bit, you can go a little bit longer. And it's kind of the beauty thing about it. And obviously you have your own podcast, the Stuff Files. And I'm pretty sure that's been a little bit better of a situation for you in terms of doing interviews like that, just to be able to have that no producer saying, you know, you only have so much time to be able to do your thing. But, you know, I mean, what was it for you to kind of do the transition over to a podcast?
Actually, it's a little different for me because I run the radio show that I run the podcast like a radio show, and it indeed plays on some radio stations. I started my radio career as a producer before I went on the on-air side, so I still adhere to a strict radio clock. So even though I'm not confined to a show that is literally an hour long, my show is an hour long, and it never goes over that. As a matter of fact, it's as tight as it's somewhere between 57 and 58 and a half minutes, and it's that way every week. So that never changes. That's just the discipline I put into putting the show together. And as a result, it is now playing on some radio stations that adhere to a regular old-fashioned radio clock, and it also has two set breaks in it. So it's a podcast that plays like a radio show.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how do you see terrestrial radio, I mean, just in your opinion, how terrestrial radio is going to be changing? Obviously, with the idea of podcasts now and streaming music and all that as well, a lot of people saying that the radio model has started dying a little bit as well. I mean, what's your thoughts about how the radio model is going, and are we going to be seeing a drastic change? Are we going to be seeing radio stations in the next decade?
I don't know how it will change, but I know one thing for a fact: it will not die. And the reason why I say that, they've been trying to kill off radio literally since it started. Talkies was going to kill off radio. Television was going to kill off radio. Getting outdoors, as more people were doing, was going to kill off radio. Everything was going to kill off radio, and all radio has done since it started, literally 100 years ago, was adapt. Radio doesn't sound anything now like it used to 50 years ago, and it didn't sound 50 years ago like it did 75 years ago. It continues to evolve and will continue to evolve. What it will sound like, who knows? But I don't think it's going away.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I was just interested in that because, you know, people keep on saying that radio is kind of in crisis right now as well. And we're seeing the kind of change in format over the past 5-6 years where, you know, the DJs are being phased out for more of a playlist format, as it were. So it's interesting to say the least in terms of it. I'm interested to see what goes on there as well. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, I mean, was there any celebrities that you've had that maybe right before they popped that you got the chance to interview?
Right before they popped? It's more the other way around. I spoke to a lot of people who were icons of their day. I'm trying to think now if there's anybody who I talked to before they popped. Oh, that's a good question. There were a few cast members from the television show Glee. I spoke to them when the show first went on the air and nobody knew who they were. But a few items like that. But most of the time it was, you know, I was a person who grew up in the 60s. So I ended up trying to track down a lot of the people who I grew up with. I mean, the thing about a lot of 60s television shows is not only did they play in the 60s, but they reran in the afternoons in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, literally you could have several generations of people who may have grown up watching television shows like Batman or Gilligan's Island or the Beverly Hillbillies. So getting people from those shows, you're really hitting a large swath of generations there.
Who was probably the one person that you had on your list to interview, or you finally got to interview, that you were so excited, that number one person? You know, I think every interviewer has that list of people they want to interview. What was your number one that you were able to get?
I don't know if I have a number one. There are people who, like I said, I was a fan first. So there are people that I was a fan of, and when I got them, I still couldn't believe I got them. People like Cloris Leachman, who I grew up watching on shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and she's an Academy Award winner for the movie The Last Picture Show, and she was in a lot of Mel Brooks movies, and she was just a delightfully fun person to talk to, and she was great. Again, growing up watching Batman, I had a crush on Yvonne Craig, who played Batgirl in the television series. So when I got a chance to talk to her, I was literally a 10-year-old boy again. There are lots of stars in that genre. Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., who was the star of the television series The FBI when I was growing up, and he was a fun person to talk to. And like the subtitle of my book mentions, two men who went on the moon. There are only 12 of them, and I talked to two of them, and I, you know, that was a lot of. As a matter of fact, I talked to one of them more than once, so that was an exciting thing to do.
Yeah, you know, it's got to be interesting to be able to talk to some of these people, and I mean, some of these people probably. The millennials may not know about. I in particular have watched a lot of, you know, 60s TV just through, yeah, afternoon television during the 80s. You know, I was there coming home from school and watching TBS, and there would be old Brady Bunch episodes running, or old Gilligan's Islands running and as well. So yeah, it's got to be really interesting as well. I mean, do you have a particular favorite 60s TV show that you like to watch?
Well, Gilligan's Island definitely is a favorite. And the thing that was fun about because one of the people I did get a chance to talk to was Bob Denver, who played Gilligan. And one of the reasons I did the interview with him is because it was kind of like a primer for work that I was doing. I also was working at the time with Just for Laughs, which is a large international comedy festival, and I was producing a few shows for Just for Laughs and also hosting a couple of them. And one of the shows I was doing one particular year was, we were doing at Just for Laughs a tribute to Sherwood Schwartz. Sherwood Schwartz was the creator of several television shows, two of the biggest hits being Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch. So we did two shows, two subsequent nights, and one of them was called a Tribute to Sherwood Schwartz, Gilligan's Island, and the next one was called a Tribute to Sherwood Schwartz, The Brady Bunch. And in both cases, Sherwood Schwartz was on stage with us. The first night, it was Bob Denver, who played Gilligan, and the second night, it was Barry Williams, who played Greg Brady on The Brady Bunch. And I was the host for both of these shows. I was in front of an audience of 400 people, and we showed unseen clips. We showed the pilot of both shows. We showed outtakes, and we got both of the people, or all the people in this case, because it's two nights, who were on the stage to talk about their experiences in the respective shows they worked on. And then we took a Q&A from the audience for the show. So as a sort of primer for doing that show, knowing I was going to do that show when they came to town, I got a chance to call all of these people beforehand and do an hour on the radio with them each as sort of a tee-up to what was going to be happening when they were coming to town to do the festival that I was working with. So it was nice to, you know, delve into the world of somebody like Bob Denver, and then sit down and talk with him and spend time with him backstage and just hang out with him. That was one of the best experiences I've had.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the Just for Laughs Festival is absolutely great. You see so many great comedians go through that festival, and it's always been talked about is one of the top comedy festivals out there as well. So it's been interesting to see the talent that's went through there as well. I mean, did you get opportunities to be able to interview some of these comedians going through the Just for Last Festival while you were working for them?
Absolutely. Well, like I said, I was working with them, so I was literally with them every day during the festival, and during some downtime, we could have a chance to talk to people who were at the festival. Not only those who were performing, but the Just for Laughs Festival was also a large tourist attraction because so many stars were coming into town to perform over the course of the two-week festival. And this would draw a lot of people coming into town to see them, including celebrities in their own right. For instance, one of the celebrities in the book that I talked to was one of the television stars of the series Law and Order, and that is Jerry Orbach, who played Detective Lenny Briscoe on Law and Order for several years. Well, I was hanging out at one of the, there was an area in town, one of the hotels, there's a bar called the Delta Hotel, the Delta Bar, and everyone and anyone who was part of the festival or who came in town for the festival used to hang out at that bar. I met Jerry there with his wife, and we started up a conversation. I said, "Hey, Jerry, would you like to do an interview?" And I interviewed him right there in the bar. We spent about 20 minutes talking about his career in Law and Order, and his career going back all the way to his Broadway and off-Broadway days. And he was just a delightful person to talk to. And here was somebody who was in town not because he was working, not because he was invited to the festival, because he had heard about the festival, he had some time off, he lived in New York, and he and his wife came to Montreal just to be part of the whole festival, the aura of the festival. And so there are many people who would come to town just for that reason. Some of them were performing, some of them were just there as fans themselves.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like I said, it's interesting, almost like Sundance, because you go to Sundance, you see a lot of celebrities that are there not because they have movies performing, but just to be there and gain connections as well. So it's kind of an interesting situation, you know, in terms of that. So, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great for you to get Jerry's interview. You know, sorry to say, he passed in the past year or so as well. I mean, it's great to be able to have gotten that get as well. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, was there a moment where you were interviewing somebody and they go into a story and you're just, your mouth just drops because you can't believe it?
I was talking to George Takei, who you may know as Sulu from Star Trek. And it's well known that William Shatner, who is, of course, Captain Kirk, while he's an immensely talented actor, can be somewhat of a difficult person to deal with. Now, it just so happens that William Shatner is himself a Montrealer, lived here in Montreal. The radio station I was working on was the number one English language talk station in the city. It was the monster radio station in the market. It was the station that anyone and everyone in the city would listen to. And at the time that I did the interview with George Takei, William Shatner's mother was still alive. And so there was a good chance that his mother was listening to the radio when I was talking to George Takei about working on Star Trek. And I asked him a question about William Shatner, and he went into this, not really a bit of a tirade, but he was going on about how Bill could be a little difficult to talk to. To deal with, he said, when I asked him about working on the show, he said it was a very talented group of people. And he also said, "I know it's kind of a cliche to say this, but we really are a family. We've been together for these 30 years now, and I look forward to each one of the movies that we do as something of a family reunion. But like any large, extensive family, there is that Uncle Jack you just can't stand, and we do have an Uncle Jack in Uncle Bill. And I said, whoa. So I said to him, are you aware of the fact that, you know, you're talking to an audience in his hometown, and that there's even a William Shatner building at the prestigious McGill University that is obviously named after him? And when I said that to him, he said, well, I know that's his hometown, and I know his mother lives there, but I'm sure she's a very sweet, dear lady, but she has certainly given birth to a supremely self-possessed man. So that's what he had to say about William Shatner right in his own backyard, literally.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. You know, sometimes you just, behind the scenes, it's interesting because some of these actors sometimes don't get along on set, although they work well on set. It's just a very interesting situation. And, you know, nowadays with what goes on in terms of the internet, you get that information, a lot quicker, because, you know, things leak, in terms of this, you know, in terms of somebody saying something or whatever. So, you know, it's interesting to say the least in terms of, you know, how people are saying stuff as well. So, and you've been around for 40 years doing these interviews as well. I mean, we talked about podcasting, but just in general, I mean, what has changed for you in terms of how interviewing has been, in terms of, you know, the past 40 years? I mean, have you changed up a lot? Have you learned a lot? Just in general, I mean, what have you learned over the past 40 years in terms of your interviewing, and has that changed a bit?
I don't think it's changed at all. I think just having a conversation with someone hasn't changed since the beginning of conversations. I don't think it's any different. Doing a radio show, doing an interview I loathe to use the term interview. Because, like I say, it's literally a conversation. It's like you've invited friends over for a dinner. You've got a large dinner table. You've got a lot of friends around the table, and you want to keep the conversation flowing and make sure that everyone's happy. That's basically what I always did when it came to doing interviews. It's not a situation where I was looking to skewer somebody with a gotcha question or dig up dirt that person might not want to have dug up. I'm not doing investigative reporting. I'm just having a chat with somebody. That's the end all and be all. So it's a friendly conversation of which an audience gets to hear. That's all it really is. And so that hasn't changed in the 40 years I've been doing it.
Just from your interviews themselves, I mean, have you learned a lot from the celebrities, and was there a big lesson that you've learned from them?
Well, the biggest lesson is the fact that they are literally just people. They're no different than you and I. They're lucky enough to have a profession that they're passionate about. And this goes for anybody in the public eye, because the same could be said for people who are in sports, for instance. They are passionate enough and talented enough at what they do that they're doing something that, in most cases, when they were growing up and given the choice, if they had the opportunity, they would do for free. It's just that in most cases they're well paid to do whatever these jobs might be. But they're no different than anybody else. They're not any more special than anyone else. They love like everyone else. They get upset like anyone else. They go through moods like anyone else. And if you treat them with respect, they're as nice as anyone else. I didn't come across any or too many prima donnas that were prima donnas just for the sake of being prima donnas. If someone was upset for one reason or another, they usually had a good reason for it. The other thing that I also found interesting is, you know, as a fan, what these celebrities owe me is a good performance. As a broadcaster, what these people owe me is absolutely nothing. I find it interesting that there are people who get upset because they go to somebody and ask for an interview and the person says no, and then, you know, that person who's trying to get the interview starts calling them names or bad-mouthing them or saying, you know, we put you where you are, you owe us an interview. No, they don't. They don't owe you anything. I would say in the hundreds of interviews I've done, and yes, the numbers of interviews I've done as far as celebrities are concerned, number into the hundreds. I would say in the hundreds of interviews I've done, for every one that I did, 9 people said no. So the ratio is still, you're going to get far more no's than you get yeses. And that's okay because, like I said, they don't owe me an interview. It's like inviting someone into your house for a dinner party, like I said before. Just because you invite someone over to your house for dinner doesn't mean they have to show up. And it's the same thing with doing an interview.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the greatest thing, too. It's just the fact that if you don't ask, then the answer is always going to be no. You know, and I've on my show, I've gotten a lot of people on the show just by simply you know, putting out a request. And then, you know, sometimes you get, I don't think you get lucky, but sometimes they'll say, yes, we have something going on, and we'd be more than happy to have this person call in on your show. So it's great to be able to have that opportunity. So absolutely love love that fact as well. I mean, just for any interviewer out there, I mean, you know, the worst thing you can do is just think that there's going to be a no all the time. Sometimes if you just dig, you know, just write a good enough letter out there and say, listen, I want to have a 15, 20 minute phone interview with a person. If they have the time, so you'll be surprised. Sometimes you will get that. So, you know, it's great to be able to have that opportunity, you know, so just kind of plug away at it and, you know, yeah, just note that you're not always going to get a yes. Just note that if you try, then, you know, there's always a possibility of you getting a yes. So, you know, it's great to be able to, you know, be able to see. So, you know, I've learned that as well, and gotten some amazing guests just by simply asking, would they be on? So, it's great to be able to see that as well. Now you're continuing with the Stuff Files right now. I mean, you know, do you have any episodes coming up, or is there anybody interesting that you've had recently?
I don't know what's coming up because, I mean, it's a week to week situation, and I'm sure it's like you like your show, you know, you're working on whatever is coming up right away. And then when you finally put that show to bed, you then got to realize, oh yeah, we have to do this all over again. I always look for the quirky, interesting guests. I just a half hour ago for next week's show, because a new show comes out every Monday, so I'm working on next Monday's show now. I just spoke to a guy who lives in Pikes Peak, and that's one of the places where there are the most sightings of Bigfoot. So we talked a little bit about that, and also, he's the only person in the world who's allowed to literally sell some of the soil from Pikes Peak. So we talked a little bit about that. That's the kind of interesting, quirky guests I like to talk to, including talking to celebrities. It's just a wide range of interesting people that are characters. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking to talk to characters. And again, it's the same as when you're talking to celebrities. Even if they're really out there characters, you treat them with the respect they deserve. They talk to you in kind, and it becomes a great conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, and speaking of which, great conversations, my interview with two men on the moon, who've been to the moon, and A Galaxy of Stars is available on Amazon. You guys can check that out as well. Stump Files, obviously, you guys can listen to the podcast as well. PeterAnthonyHolder.com, you guys can check out the podcast there. Also, the Stump Files on Facebook and at I believe, PA Holder on Twitter. You guys can check them out as well. Anything else at all, Peter?
And it's also, for those who are on Patreon, you can find it at patreon.com as well.
And yeah, you can check out some really cool swag as well over on his website as well too. So I'll give you a plug for that as well.
Thank you.
It's great. It's been great to be able to talk to you. Like I said, interviewer to interviewer. I've learned a lot in the past nine or so years that I've been doing it. It's exciting to be able to see, you know, over a career, just to be able to see how many people you've talked to and to be able to say that you've had a really great conversation with them as well. So, best of luck to you coming in the next year. I'm interested to see what other people that you get on your show as well. Again, thanks for joining us to get some time out.
Thanks for allowing me to be on your program. Who knows, maybe in a couple of years, your book will come out.
Yeah, I might have to. I mean, I've had a lot of comedians on. I've always been wanting to, so.
Thank you very much, Mark.
No problem at all, Peter. And I said best of luck to you.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Yeah. That was Peter Anthony Holder, everybody. You guys should check him out. PeterAnthonyHolder.com. Really great guy. You guys can check out his book, Great Conversations. With two men on the moon, that have been on the moon and a galaxy of stars on Amazon, PeterAnthonyHolder.com. Like I said, you guys check it out as well. My next guest also has a book out talking a little bit about his career as a musician and songwriter and all that as well. It's an interesting ride for him in terms of how he's gotten to that point and, how he got to the point of being a musician and songwriter. And there's been some really trials and tribulations and a native of Oakland. How music saved my life from the darkness into the light. My life as a 70s R&B soul singer is the name of his book. Really privileged to have Chris Bell on with us right now. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm doing good. How's it been for the past? And how's it for you? Are you in California? Where are you at?
I'm in Georgia. I moved to Georgia several years ago. I moved to Georgia.
Yeah, a lot of active scene right now in Georgia. A lot of movies are being produced out there right now. Pretty interesting music scene out there as well. We get a lot of the Southern soul out there, I guess, out in the Atlanta area and all that as well. So it must be an interesting. I don't know how. Do you ever go out into the music scene out there in Georgia?
Well, I'm not. I really am not, because most of the time I'm not here. I'm usually, if I'm not on tour in Europe, I'm in Argentina. So I really haven't been in touch with most of the scene here at all.
Now, that's interesting because, Europe has a very interesting music scene in itself where, we're seeing, well, first of all, I've had a lot of country guys on here that do tours of Europe, and you would never expect that to be very big as well. And then, we see some more of the traditional American stylized music, such as soul and R&B, head over there as well and do very, very well for themselves. I mean, how's it been for you to be able to do your thing over in Europe and to be able to see the fans and their reaction?
Well, most of the time, it's really, really great. They're very loyal a fan base in Europe for our music. So for me, it has been really a really good experience just to be able to go over there and perform for them.
Yeah, I said it's great as well. Let's dive into a little bit of your history. I mean, like many of my guests that have been on, I mean, you basically started out in church choir, correct?
Yeah, I started at home because my mother was a vocalist. But we all went to church, or at least in my generation, we went to church back in those days. But most of my musical training came from my mother.
Now, with that in mind, I mean, where did you kind of start off with? Did you start off with the singing? Did you learn an instrument while you were growing up?
Yes, there were four children, and we actually had what would be considered today a just at home a band, because I started off playing bass, and my sister would play drums, my mother would play piano, and we would sing, and she taught us our harmonies, and we'd sing the songs that were back in the 40s and 50s. We would sing those songs. So yes, I did start off playing bass. My bass was actually a big silver tub and a broomstick and a piece of string, and that's what I used for a bass when I first started playing.
Now, did you end up? You obviously ended up, moving around from bass to other instruments, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, I played a little piano, not as much. My main instrument was my voice. I was always a very good vocalist, and I had been singing since I was my first live gig. I was 12 years old. I sang at a contest, One Second Place, and this was when, as I said, I was 12 years old when that first happened. So, singing was. My voice is still my main instrument.
Yeah, it's very interesting, to say the least, in terms of, having to harmonize and find the right group of people. I mean, tell me a little bit about how the Natural Four got started.
Well, Natural Four started in 1967. I met one of the original members, Al Bowden. Everybody knew him as Punkin. I met him at General Motors. They had a group called the Dynamic Dimensions, and they were looking for another vocalist at the time. I auditioned for them under the name of the Dynamic Dimensions, and then about 6 months later, we changed the name because Naturals were a big thing back then. We changed the name from the Dynamic Dimensions to the Natural Four, and that was myself, Punkin, John January, and Alan Richardson was the original Natural Four from 68 to 70. And then it changed to the latter three gentlemen, which was Daryl Kennedy, Steve Striplin, myself, and Delmas Whitley.
Yeah, now you were assigned to the Curtis Mayfield's record company, and what was it like working with him and obviously a big star at the time.
Well, Curtis, yes, it was really an honor for us to actually get signed with him. We did a cover from his Superfly movie called Eddie, You Should Know Better, and he heard us do it, and it was about maybe a month later he decided to sign us up, and that was in 71, 72 that he heard us. And signed us up in 72. So from 72 to 76, we worked with Curtis. And Curtis was a very good producer and record company owner. So that was, for me, that was probably the highlight of my life. Even though we started off on ABC Records, we ended up on Warner Brothers Records and Curtom as a mother company for us. But it was really an honor working with Curtis. I got to see him just before his serious accident, and we had planned, and I hadn't seen him in several years, and we had actually planned on doing some more work together, and then his accident happened, so that didn't happen. But working with Curtis was really good. He had a lot of good producers, a lot of good songwriters in his stable at the time. We spent most of we did all of our recording for Curtom in Chicago.
Yeah, again, Chicago, a big town in terms of rhythm and blues as well. I mean, you got to, hang out with probably some of the best talent at the time in terms of the R&B circuit as well. I mean, how was did you learn a lot? Did you learn a lot from those guys?
Oh, yeah. In studio, we learned quite a bit because prior to that, we had worked in a smaller studio in California. But you'd be able to actually go into Curtom Records, and they had their whole office and the studios in-house, and we got to work with them. It's the first time I got a chance to meet Natalie Cole. I met Chuck Jackson, Marvin Yancey. We got to meet quite a few artists when we were going in, when we were with Curtom Records. So for me, again, it was a very good experience. It was a learning experience because Curtis, as I said, was a good producer. Even though Leroy Hutson produced most of the stuff on us, Curtis was still always involved in what we did, so it was always a good experience for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, how the music scene was back then versus what it is today. And, the ability to record. And like I said, you can get that feel of the studio and all that as well. Did you learn a lot in terms of, did you ever go to the board or see what a producer was doing? Or, Did you learn a lot about the basically the process of recording? I mean, obviously, California is maybe a smaller studio, might be a little bit different than what you might have experienced in Chicago.
No, yes, actually, it was being able to go to Curtone Records in Chicago that I actually became an engineer myself, and I've eventually have had my own studio. I run the John Lee Hooker Studio, which is called Boom Boom Recording Studios, which started in California, more in-home. It was more in-house type of the situation. But, yes, I learned I learned a lot. It was a different way of recording back then because you were dealing with 2-inch tape and then quarter-inch tape and how you had to splice things. So it was a different process, but I learned a lot of techniques on how to actually how to mix, what equipment you can use to help the different sounds. It was a different, because it was all analog when I first started, and digitally it came back in the 90s, after the 80s and 90s, it started becoming very digital. But the analog for me was really a good training ground.
Now, you know, R&B has come a long way. I mean, from the days that you guys were recording to now, I think there are some artists that have kind of stuck with the traditional R&B roots, but other artists have taken it in a different direction as well. I mean, how have you seen the kind of the music, R&B music and soul music scene change over the past couple of years? And are you seeing that there are some people that are traditional and some people that are taking it to a different direction?
Well, because everything went digital, things have changed. And because when people go into the studios now, the thing that I find that is difficult for me to really grasp, I don't mean in terms of understanding, but there was no such thing as auto-tune when I started recording. Either you could sing on key or you couldn't sing on key. So the big differences for me has been the ability to have someone that can't really stay on pitch be able to correct their pitch. Things like that didn't happen back when I was doing my recording in the 70s. That wasn't happening. You went into the studio, you learned the song, you did your part, you stayed on key. If you got off key, you got help to get on key. Those things don't happen now. I have to say that I personally don't like the fact that I have to tune a vocal that should be in tune when it starts. I can understand the upside of that is where you can pump things out. I see the difference between pumping out 15 songs in a day where it used to take maybe 6, 8, 9, 10, 12 weeks to finish something. Everything is done really quickly these days. And I think that there is a loss in terms of reality musically because people are not really taking it as serious as we did back then because everybody's going to the studio. Everybody has a home studio now. Everybody thinks they're a vocalist. And, again, for me, that's a problem because I'm still from the old school, and that's where the music was the solidest back in the day. When Marvin Gaye was out, the Supremes, the Temptations, the OJs, the real vocalists. Again, things change, and you have to accept it. But for me, it doesn't change. I believe when people come to my studio, you come in there and you can sing, and I'm going to do the right thing by you vocally. I could go on and on about that, but it's just how it is these days.
And that kind of suffers in terms of live performance, too, because you can't auto-tune during a live performance. So you have to be on key. So, you know, that's always that. There's always that as well. So, yeah, it's kind of disappointing to see that still has happened, but you still have to be on key in order to perform live. So there's always that hang up in terms of trying to do kind of auto-tuning.
Yeah, well, you're right. Live performances tells the story. You know, there have been some groups out there that have tried to, for a better word, fake it. The bottom line is, when you hit the stage, be on key, be on point, because if you don't, the audience is going to know. But nowadays, I think that they've kind of pushed that type of quality to the side, and they do minimal singing. They don't do the same things, as I said, that Marvin Gaye did, or Barry White, or Isaac Hayes, or Al Green. They don't do this kind of singing anymore. It's all really quick and get done, and a lot of synthesized things. Again, I'm still from the old school, so if it works for them and it happens for them, yeah, what can I say? I'm still going to remain the same. I'm going to always be able to perform real and do real good vocals, and hopefully people accept that.
Yeah, when you get into the composing, on the other side of things, composing music as well, I mean, is there something, obviously some people, you know, usually get the melody in their head first, or sometimes there's lyrics that come first, or sometimes it's a little bit of both. How's it for you to be able to compose a song? And, I know a lot of artists that I've talked to, you know, usually have, at least a pen or paper handy in order to start writing things down in terms of that as well. But how's it for you to be able to think creatively and get a song together?
Well, when it comes to lyrics, again, it comes with the melody of the song, depending, and when I work with people, depending on who it is. Like if I work with my sons, we'll go through the lyrics. Both my sons are very creative when it comes to music. And you sit down, you come up with, like my oldest son comes up with music, myself and my youngest son, we can come up with the lyrics and the title of the song. We'll see what works. And that, to me, is the best way to do it. Sit down, you know, write these things down. One of us will either write the lyrics down. The other one, like my son Mark, he will come up with the music, and myself and Christopher, we will sit down and do pen. Christopher's very quick at writing lyrics. But my sons have learned this because they've been around music all their lives.
Okay, yeah, we have another call. I just want to check who it is. 510, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Who's
this? Hi, Chris. This is Crystal. How are you? I just want to call and say congratulations on your wonderful book. Music saves everybody's life, we hope. And I'm just calling in to wish you much success. I love you, the Natural Four Classic Bay Area group. And I just want to say congratulations, sir. And you're an amazing artist. I have
Thank
a clue,
you,
by the way.
Thank you, Crystal.
You're welcome. So I'm going to continue to tune in, and I really, I'm very proud of you, Chris. You're an amazing
you.
Artist
that.
And person. Okay?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes, I appreciate that.
Yes, so God bless you, and you guys have a wonderful interview.
You too. Thank you, Crystal.
Thank
Take
you,
care.
Crystal.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, I mean, that was nice of Crystal.
that was true.
Yeah, it's interesting once in a while when you do get the fans calling in and wishing you the greatest as well. I mean, you know, really, I mean, your life. I mean, you've had to overcome a lot in terms of your life. Your mother was a mixed blessing, but the fact that she taught you music, but yet. was very abusive, you know, with you growing up as well. I mean, and then plus any obstacles that you've come through as well. I mean, tell me a little bit about, you know, how it was for you to, it's like go over that experience and how tougher it made you when, you know, situations like that came up later in life.
Well, for me, I really believe that the thing that just saved me from being depressed all the time was that I always had as a companion. I always had music. I had something to fall back on, and hopefully my book will speak to that. It doesn't have to be music, but something, you need something sometimes when you have turmoil in your life. You need something to kind of move that aside, and you should be allowed to have the luxury of whatever it is. If you draw, if you paint, whatever it is, you always need some type of an outlet. For me, music was the outlet. It's the thing that kept me functioning. It's the thing that kept me focused. And to this day, it truly is a good friend for me.
Yeah, you know, and you're still going at it. I mean, you're still touring and that as well. I mean, it's great to be able to hear that you're still out and about going to Europe and going to Argentina as well. I mean, do you do a lot of domestic dates at all here in the United States? I mean, how often do you perform here locally?
Actually, I have not. I think we performed once last year here in the States, but because myself and my wife both perform, she usually gets the dates, and I usually play bass for her, and I sing on her shows. As a single artist, it's very rare that I perform by myself nowadays. But I do like to spend time, again, performing in any place outside of the country. I haven't done a whole lot here in Georgia. This is, even though this is where I live, it's not my home base. I would like to do more here, but there's certain protocols here that are quite a bit different than they are in California. And as I said, I'm fine with that because I spend a lot of time in Europe and I spend a lot of time in Argentina doing shows there. And as you get older, you slow down. So I'm happy with the shows that I do, whether they're here and or not here. I'm happy with them.
Is there any certain place that you would like to visit that you haven't visited yet?
Yes, actually, I would. I have never been to. I've never been to Africa. I've been to most of the Scandinavian countries, but I've never been to Africa. And I definitely would like to tour there if the opportunity presented itself. I would love to tour there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it'd be great. I mean, I think they'd really love your and your wife's music. Zakiya is actually a veteran of the show. She's done an interview with me before as well. I mean, it's great to be able to hear, you two as a collaboration as well. I'm interested to see how your sons are turning out. I mean, are they currently doing any projects or anything that they're doing at the moment?
No, nothing specific. My son has a nonprofit organization for underprivileged kids in California, in Richmond, California, and he's teaching them engineering and also having them write material and stuff like that. But there's no particular shows at this time that we're working on. We're supposed to get together at the beginning of the year to try to do some shows, which I'm looking forward to doing that.
Well, I mean, it's great to hear. I mean, even just to get some of these kids, organizing and doing songwriting, I think that's great to be able to do as well. I think that sometimes, people you tend to go into the singing first and songwriting second. And there's a lot of people out there that may not be that great at singing, but, are talented songwriters. So I'm interested to see how some of these young prodigies may be going through your son's organization and see how they go as well.
He's doing a really good job. What I'm hearing is that he's doing a good job and that he does have quite a few really talented young people in his classes, and that's good to hear. And hopefully I'll be able to actually join him. Again, he's in California and I'm here in Georgia, so there's definitely, even though things are done via the internet, it's still better to have hands-on. I plan on going there in February for a fundraiser for kids in the Bay Area, and I'm sure that him and I will get a chance to do some work while I'm there.
Like I said, that sounds absolutely great to be able to do that next year. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that as well. Are you taking the holidays off pretty much from touring? Are you and Zakiya going to be doing any touring at all?
Well, no, not well. Yeah, we actually took the holidays off. We start again on the 18th of February with a fundraiser in California for music, because they took music out of the schools. There's under the Johnny Hooker Foundation, they're doing a fundraiser to raise money for music programs in the schools. So we're looking forward to doing that, and that is the 18th of February. That'll be the first gig that we do this coming year.
That's great to hear. You guys can just definitely check out the book. I believe it's over on Amazon, I'm assuming.
Yes, it is. It's on Amazon.com. I know if they want to get it on my website, it's chrisjames-natural4.com. And they can look at my website, and it's on there, but it's definitely on Amazon.
Yeah, music saved my life from darkness into the light. My life as a 70s R&B and soul singer. You guys can check that out as well. Anything else coming up for you?
No, that's about it. I'm just glad to be here. You know, so many of my comrades have gone on, and I'm still hanging in, and I'm just, you know, thankful to still be alive and still be able to do my music. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, you know, to be able to still compose and to be able to still perform, and you know, it's great, and a great musical family as well. And happy holidays to you. Best of luck to you coming into the new year as well. And my best is Zakiya. I really liked having her as an interview as well. And definitely we'll look out for that book and anything else that comes out from you as well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care and God bless.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was soul singer Chris Bell, also known as Chris James. You guys can check him out on his website, and definitely check out his book as well. No show next week, I don't think. I don't think we'll be doing a show for the next 2 weeks as well. I think we may be off for the holidays because I think the next week I don't have any guests booked. The following week I'm not going to be available, and then the following week is Christmas. So we might not do a show until the new year. Depending on certain things, we may do one right before the new year starts, but I will let you guys know on that. At SWIV on Twitter, SWIV on Twitter, you guys check that out as well. And Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook, you guys can check that out as well. I really hope everybody has a great holiday season. Like I said, we probably won't be back until the new year. I may have to do I skipped it for the past couple of years, but my annual Elvis special usually happens the first Monday of the year, celebrating the life and death of Elvis Presley, but that's going to have to, I will let you guys know on that as well. So make sure you guys check out the social media, and we'll let you know on that as well. Again, thank you for a great year of shows. I know I've been off for a couple of months just because of things that just happened, but it's great to be able to have the guests that we've had on so far. Well, of exciting 2018, a couple guests already pretty much lined up for February. So I want to wish everybody a happy holidays from here at Somewhere in Vegas. We'll be back, like I said, probably in the new year, if not right before it. I mean, if not the day before, but like I said, I'll let you guys know on that as well. And you guys remember, you guys can check us out on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. I should mention that as well. Just look up Somewhere in Vegas on either platform. You'll be able to hear our shows and some of our great shows from the past couple of weeks. We've been on a roll lately, so definitely check that out as well. With that in mind, we will see you guys in the new year, 2018, hopefully, for Somewhere in Vegas during our big, huge 10th year as well. So with that in mind, we'll talk to you guys in a few weeks here on Somewhere in Vegas. Happy holidays, everybody.